Welcome to Star Wars Universe On Call. I am Paul France, owner of France Games, I'm on SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder how to join us for a talk cast every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444, just call, use the call ID 17702. Or you can participate on the web, just go to the Talkshoe website at www.talkshoe.com. And search for call ID 17702 or Starfleet Universe On Call or SFU On Call, you should be able to find us there. But if you want the best online experience, what you want to go to is twitch.tv/SFU On Call. And you'll find us there. You'll be able to join the chat room and watch my lovely face. And of course, you need to contact me for any reason. My email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, you want to follow me on Twitter. My account's there, or the personal account is Paul France, PAUFRNZ. There's no T in that. Podcasting account, which is SFU On Call. And my business account, which is France Games. Which will keep up to date with everything that's going on over there. And of course, there's a lovely podcast, Gets to Know Podcast, available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Some quick news from ADP this week. Ramen Border is now in stock. Also, on Monday, this July 29th, Steve Allen broke his hip. On the 30th at noon, he was scheduled for hip replacement surgery, which happened. He's still in the hospital. Not sure if he's in the hospital. I know he's currently doing physical therapy, which sucks. I think he's going to be doing that for approximately a month to next 6 weeks. And Steve Cole mentioned that it was really painful, the physical therapy. That does not surprise me. But anyway, moving to found an online store for this week. You have the Romulans PD-20. Also $24.95, like the previous PD-20 modules. Also, basically, it's everything you ever wanted to know about the distant cousins of the Vulcans, the royal family, the role of the Praetor, the great houses and how they wheel and deal in the back halls of the palace, the role of the Intendant's department, intelligence the services, and the Praetorium teams, colony planets, and the previously unknown suppressed races along the Galactic Rim, the development of the cloaking device, and much, much more. Moving onward and forward to the SFB Online tournaments, Step Our Start 17 tournament. Currently, there are already 16 signups, so you don't really... we've gotten some more additional signups, but I'm going to assume that Steve Petcher is going to notify them that they are currently backups for the tournament. Because we're still waiting for Petcher to come back so that we can start the tournament. Moving on to the online client, that actually is an updated release that I just released this past weekend. Again, it's one of those things that it takes me like 4 hours to complete the whole process. So that's why I try not to release it too much because of it just takes so much time to just release the product. But anyway, I fixed the issue with exporting units. Also, I released the update, which I viewed to you guys months ago, which is the copy-paste drone loadout feature, which is really cool, and I think everyone will enjoy it. Those who want to set up their drone loadouts and so forth will be definitely appreciate that, especially because you can save them off. And it's really kind of cool. If you haven't watched the video, please do. I will probably record a separate video for those people who have the client. I might just do a copy paste, cut out that little part of the podcast and post it up on YouTube as a separate video. Also, I fixed the problem with launching drones in the Federation used in Federation Commander. And also for the SFB side, I removed the log/notes tabs because I don't think any people were really needed to be in a tab. So I seen them to be a tab. I removed from the tabs there's two less tabs, which is good. I'm trying to slim things down. And now they're just pop-up windows. You can still bring them up. You can still view them. You just have to right-click on the board and select Show Logs or Show Notes. And yeah. Moving on forward, when it comes to the library report, there's nothing happening there. No updates for the SAP or FedCom. So with that is the news for this week. Then it's me, I'm Simon Popkins, welcoming you, the star of the universe, on call. And tonight, we got moi, the beautiful moi. And we have Gary. Say hi, Gary.
Hi, Gary.
Cool. And at the moment, I don't see Doug on, but he might stop by a little later this evening. In the meantime, I'm sorry, I'm bringing up Twitch, and I'm hearing about how Amazon, hey, they're losing money on Twitch, losing money on the Echo products. It's like, okay, you're obviously getting a lot of money from your web services, your AWS, and probably from a lot of your sale, you know, selling through your store. What else? It's like, I don't know. It just seems weird to me that they're going to be losing money and still having them running, and they're talking about, oh, we're not sure what we're going to do about Twitch and all this kind of thing. Well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see if they completely either sell off Twitch or shut it down, because it's costing them money. I doubt they'll shut it down. It's a question of how they're going to make money, or at the very least, I would hope they, even if they would make money, you know, break even, you know, so it's worth having it around, and I'm not sure what else they're going to do with it. I don't know. I'm hearing from the Daily Tech News Show, it's a podcast I listen to. Tom Merritt was mentioning how he thinks they should do like a TikTok style videos. And I go, I don't think so. Twitch is always known for live streaming. What can you do to promote that and make money off that? I don't know. Maybe get it so that you become the clearinghouse for advertisers. You know, I think, I didn't know that. Dave was just mentioning that the post office is now selling D&D stamps, Dungeons and Dragons, for those who don't know what D&D are, which if you don't, bad. I'm sorry. Wasn't talking on mute, which would be interesting. Forgive me. But anyway, I disagree with that. I think in theory, Amazon can become a clearinghouse for advertisers and have it so that you have interstitial ads that you can ask. Basically, you have the people who stream, you know, especially the larger streamers. If you can put in ads, and what you can do is, you know, you can tell them, okay, we're going to be doing an ad now, or it gives a countdown to ad, and then say, okay, so that they can kind of sign off while the ad is played, take a break, and then come back, you know. But that, I would think that would be one way of making money, or at least cutting in half, you know, the idea of making a live TV, like a live channel, you know, a TV channel, that kind of thing, where you support the running of the whole network by adding ads. That, yeah, you work as the clearinghouse for those ads, and then the people who do this, the streaming, can get a little money back from those ads that are placed on the Twitch network. But you obviously, Amazon would get the larger portion of the ad money. So I think that'd be a good idea. But that's me.
Speaking of ads, because just before the start of the recording, I was mentioning that the KBO League has a live streaming service available in North America. It's SOOP. I don't know if you meant to pronounce that soap or soup, but when you're actually watching it, not only do they have ads between breaks, like say each half of the inning, mm-hmm. sometimes they'll actually put an ad on the screen between pitches. Like the camera angle will be in such a way that the pitcher is facing down to the bottom right, and there's like a big patch of grass beside him. Mm-hmm. And then in the grass, you'll see kind of like a bubble of like a mini car, or you'll see some guys doing something or whatever like that. It's basically just in case there weren't enough ads in the single inning. So but I suppose in theory, depending on how much empty space a streamer had, like in their feed, then they could have something like that come up or whatever. And I mean, it wouldn't be ideal if used to the more PBS side of things, but it would be better than, you know, mm-hmm. artificially breaking up the stream to go for separate ad breaks and then come back.
Right, right. Question about those ads: are those like videos or just static ads? Like a picture
they're
or something.
They're kind of like, I don't know how to explain it. They're like, they're animated, but they kind of like, they come up in the middle of the graph, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
Like, for example, like the movie Twisters, you mm-hmm. don't see a fake looking tornado in the middle of the field. And then the characters for the movie Twisters appear out of it and
oh, okay.
it just disappears again. So.
Okay. Yeah, I asked because I know MLB already has that, you know, for the stadiums. If you ever seen some of the MLB games, you'll have advertisements in the background because it's usually like a couple of I guess call them banner ads, but they're not as obnoxious banner ads are. But you know, in the background, you see places where there normally yeah. would be ads, and actually, in some cases, those ads or just overlaying the local ad that is in the stadium itself. You know,
I hate when they do that because it's like, it's better to see the original ad as well. But also, sometimes it's a bit weird. So, for example, American MLB teams have ads from the U.S. Navy, like, say, to build submarines, which is perfectly fine, you know. But when the Blue Jays are playing, like, if the Blue Jays are playing on Sportsnet in Canada, then they don't show those ads because... And we have a Navy in Canada, but we don't really have the same industry. Like, we have to import them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're watching, say, for example, like on Friday evenings, the games are covered by Apple rather than by the local broadcaster or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So Apple will actually superimpose the local Canadian ad that's in the Sky Dome for the Blue Jays home game with the ad for building submarines. So it's like, I mean, are they trying to get Canadians to build submarines? So it's like, I mean, there's that line between an ad that's perfectly fine and appropriate, like in one context, but is odd in the other. And also, I mean, because I think part of the fun is actually seeing what the local ads are. Like, if I'm watching a KBO game, like, you know, I can't sleep, then I want to see the Korean ads. I want to see how different they are compared to the North American ones. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, you want to have that local flavor of the game, the thing that's going on. And so there's that kind of like, you know, line to be kind of hovered around in terms of how much of the experience are you presenting is authentic to the place that it's in and how much of it is being directed by computer graphics that detract from the experience, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, I totally understand. And actually, that's one thing that bothered me at first, but I've gotten used to it, which is as of this year, MLB has added ads, you know, can actually hit, uniforms actually have advertisers like you have for like a race car driver. Not as blatant as that. Currently, they have to be very tasteful. A lot of times, arm patches is what they are at the moment. They have an arm patch in case of, I think, the Orioles, they have, was it TJ Price, I think it is, or TJ Rowe? I think it is. Yeah, one of the financial companies. Is to currently
the Blue Jays have TD Bank.
Mm-hmm.
The Blue Jays have TD Bank. That's one of the big five Canadian banks up here.
Mm-hmm.
But although TD are actually in the U.S. as well, they have Boston Bruins and the Celtics. Mm-hmm. Their stadium sponsor is the American version of TD.
Hmm.
And there's another Canadian bank, BMO. They sponsor stadiums in Canada, but the American subsidiary of BMO now sponsors the home stadium for LAFC over in Los Angeles. So.
Understood.
But yeah, if you're thinking about sponsorships on jerseys, then again, the likes of KBO and NPB and CPBL, mm-hmm. they're kind of ahead of the curve because like the KBO teams, for example, because they're all owned by Chiba, like the big Korean corporations.
Yeah.
The team has the name in it. So, but right. also the jersey has it too. And it has, so for example, like there was one of the teams, it's got Shinsegae. They're basically, they used to be connected with Samsung, but they were split by the Korean government into a separate thing. They're kind of like a, I guess like Macy's or something like that. They're like a big department store chain, retailer. Mm-hmm. And so their logo's on there. But then on one patch, there's Korean Airways and there's Hyundai Card, which is basically Diners Club, but Hyundai bought it because and then converted it in, turned it into a card that with their own branding. And then there's some other team on the other side, corporation on the other side. I forget who it is. But yeah, so I mean, that kind of stuff is, I mean, sometimes it can get out of hand, I agree. But it's not quite as bad as, for example, like in some countries, in soccer in particular, the jerseys are just caked with logos, and I feel it really detracts from it. So, like, for example, right now, Apple, I don't know if Apple has it, but anyway, there's a competition between Liga MX and MLS teams.
Mm-hmm.
Now, MLS teams do have a certain amount of branding on their shirts,
right.
but the Mexican teams have way more. And I find it very off-putting in terms of, like, it basically detracts from the quality. You know, like, it's like in England, for example, the Premier League, when mm-hmm. it first set up, separate from the old Division One,
mm-hmm.
they had corporate branding for the league. But eventually they got to the point where they realized the name of the league itself was a brand. And they
right.
kind of felt that it was detracting from that brand to have it tied to a sponsor.
Right,
so,
right.
And then, for example, in Germany, Germans Football Federation, the DFB, they don't allow corporate sponsorship at all. So, for example, Red Bull owns a team in Leipzig. And unlike every other Red Bull team, like Red Bull New York and MLS, the team in Leipzig has to be called RB, which in theory is Rasenballsport or Lawn Ball Sport, but everyone knows it's Red Bull. But the jersey is modified so that it still has two bowls on it. And it's still, like, if you take 5 seconds to look at it, you'll know it's Red Bull.
Mm-hmm.
But it's abstracted enough to pass off as that little bit more kind of removed from the sponsor.
Right.
And they're still a very controversial team. But the thing is that part of the reason why is because the eastern part of Germany, its soccer clubs collapsed basically after the unification.
Right.
And even now in the first division, almost all the teams in Germany are in West Germany.
Right.
So the fact that Red Bull were able to go to Leipzig and be the only ones to invest that kind of money is basically showing just how the fall of the Berlin Wall has had an ongoing impact, even when it comes to like sporting events and stuff. So,
understood. Anyway. Yeah, that surprises me about East Germany that after all these years after reunification, that they're still, it sounds like they're still considered like what Southern Italy is, which is the poorer part of the country, you know. So, anyway, I see that Doug's here. Say hi, Doug.
Hi.
Hi, Doug.
So,
how's everybody doing tonight?
Good, good. Oh, before we start anything else, before I forget again, there will be no podcast next week because I need to pick up my wife very, very early in the morning on Friday. So I can't record a podcast where I'm going to be ending up going to bed at 11 o'clock when I have to wake up so early to pick up my wife at 6 o'clock in the morning. So it's like, no. So,
okay.
Yeah. So I'm just going to say, no, I'm going to do it. I got to tell my work I'm taking the day off just because I'm going to be waking up right and early by the time I come bring back my wife back home. I'm probably just going to go right back to bed. This is what I'm going to do. So, anyhow, I just want to say that now. So, everyone knows there's going to be no podcast next week. Because I didn't put it in the news portion. I didn't put it at the beginning of this podcast. The stream, the live stream. So, I just want to do it now before I forget yet again. So, there.
I will totally forget that and ask you next week if we're having a podcast.
I'm sure you will.
Okay.
Well, onward and forward. Gary, you said there was something about the Borac that you had an idea about?
Okay, so before I continue, before I begin, I just want to pass on my best wishes to Steve Cole and along with everyone in the ADB community. I'd wish for him a speedy recovery as is possible given the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Same here. Peace.
So, So if you think back to Module C6 and Module R4J, mm-hmm. they both came with multiple timelines that were presented as, mm-hmm. at least somewhat plausible. What if this happened? What if that happened? And so forth. And the result is basically allowing the empires in those modules to be playable in the modern Alpha era. Now, when it comes to the Borac, they're still technically in playtest because they're in Module E3. They're not in a full C module, at least not for now. Although I'd reckon that they'd probably need to be split up into other modules. So, for example, their earlier's materials would probably be in Module Y4 rather than being in Module C7 or C8 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But for now, at least, there's only two versions of Borac history. One of them is the real one, where the Borac were basically interspersed with the Hydran colonies in the off map. And so, for example, there'd be often cases where the Hydrans and Borac would agree to colonize the same star system, and it would be mutually beneficial until the Hydrans got paranoid when they lost the homeworld the first time and drove the Borac from space.
Right.
From that point on, the Borac became a subject species, but treated more or less the same way that the exile species are treated on map later on. So still right. running their own affairs, still settling various planets, and even sometimes the Hydrans would basically transport Borac, they'd be willing to transport Borac to new colony worlds so that they could expand their reach within, under Hydran rule. The second version of events is the one that the deception history, the one that they basically used to try to spoof the coalition in the general war. That one basically pretended that there was actually a separation, like a neutral zone, so to speak, between a part of the off-map zone that's Borac and a part of the off-map zone that's Hydran. So in that version of events, there was no intermingling of colonies. The Borac were way off to the, maybe they're basically off to the far side of the Delta sector from the Hydrans. And so they basically continued to survive as their own empire, at least in the simulators.
Right.
And but that still sets them as, it's basically non-historical because it doesn't match how the Borac and Hydrans actually met.
Right.
But it still keeps the Borac away from the rest of the Alpha Octant because one of the things that ADB has said is that the off-map zones between the Lyrans and Hydrans cannot meet. But there's the void further along actually extends all the way across the Delta sector. So there is no way to travel from the old colonies directly to the Lyran Fire Stars Duchy or back again. You have to go onto the map and then go back off-map again. So that basically means that even if the Borac deception history was true, they're isolated. Like there's no way to actually get them part of until the Andromedans invade, basically, because the invaders can try to reach them in the off map or if they want to. And I'm not entirely sure if either version of history is really ideal in terms of actually giving people at least the same kind of plausibility that Module C6 gives for the Paradins and Karn bombs.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a different idea, and I wanted to run it by you to see if you thought it made sense or not. So in the historical timeline, the Hydrans and Borac, when they first met, their relations were amicable, but they weren't anything more than trade. Like, there was no military alliance, there's no further economic or political union or whatever like that. Mm. And, but it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
So what I was thinking is that maybe the Hydrans and Borac actually developed a more integrated relationship, like a commonwealth even, where so that eventually, before the first return to the on map in the 1135, the Commonwealth had basically become like a more kind of like integrated whole, in the sense that Borac would continue to build their ships, and the Hydrans would build their ships in the old colony shipyard, and the two fleets would be able to collaborate together. And there would actually still be, like in Federation and Empire terms, mm-hmm. there would be an off-map capital hex, so to speak, representing the Borac home system and its surrounding colonies. And so you would still have like a single Commonwealth economy. So you wouldn't have, like you'd basically, so what I was thinking is that, say, if all of the resources that are basically generated within Hydran / Borac space, you would add it all up, and then you would associate a certain percentage of the total that would always go to the Borac, and a certain percentage that would always go to the Hydrans. And the swing amounts in the middle could be allocated by the Commonwealth player to the Borac or to the Hydrans or to both, depending on the situation. So that there would always be at least some Hydran and some Borac ships getting built and replaced and upgraded and so on. But you might find a flexibility in terms of how many of one empire's one coalition partner, so to speak, one side's ships are being built compared to the others. And so what that would mean is that starting in 1135, when the first liberation happens, Borac ships would appear alongside the Hydrans against the Lyrans and Xinti, against the Xintis and Klingons, rather. Sorry, the Lyrans and Klingons, rather. And from that point on, you would continually see Borac and Hydran ships fighting together. So even if the Hydrans get driven off Hydrax the second time, Borac ships would be involved in the defense, and Borac ships would be fighting alongside the Hydrans to try to retake the Hydran homeworld again. And further on again, when you get to the Andromedan War, the Andros would basically have two capital hexes to try and attack the Hydran one and also the Borac one. So throughout all this process, you would have that ongoing balancing act in terms of, like, say the Hydrans get driven off Hydrax the second time. In Federation and Empire terms, the Hydrans have very special rules in terms of upgrading the old colony shipyard to full shipyard status when they lose the homeworld, and how much that costs and how many turns that takes and how long it lasts for and so forth. But if you only have so much money in the treasury off map when you lose the homeworld, and if the Borac are continuing to exist and have a shipyard and you're already sharing a budget with them, would it make sense as a Commonwealth player to spend more of that money on the Borac rather than the Hydrans, so that you're actually basically getting a proportionally larger number of Borac ships in your fleet? Or in the long run, is it better to continue to invest in the Hydran Old Colony shipyard the way you would have in the historical timeline, despite the fact that every time you do that, there's one less Borac ship you're building each turn? And how would that basically have a knock-on effect, you know, even after the war, like, for example, when the ISC or the Andros, as we mentioned, come in? And ultimately, when it comes to get back to SFB or Fedcom for that matter, because there's playtest Borac ships for Fedcom as well, most of the assumptions have been that the Borac were basically simulator ships were being used by the Hydrans for their own use in terms of, like, practicing against a dissimilar enemy. But if the assumption is that the Borac and Hydran ships are actually fighting on the same side, and they're having to basically combine their fleet tactics and basically find ways that they can work off each other against Lyran and Klingon opposition, how interesting would that make things go, you know, in the middle years of the general war area or the area of ships and so forth, in an SFB or Fedcom perspective? So, long story short, if you basically merged the Hydras and Borg into a joint faction and had them basically be who the Lyrans and Klingons are fighting, do you think that that would be more interesting than rather keeping the Borg off map or having them just be conquered as they were historically?
Well, here's the problem. I think it's an interesting idea to have them more of, not quite the Commonwealth, but more of the Hydrans have the Borak, something like, almost like, well, I was going to say the Vudar and the Klingons, but I don't, it's not quite the same. But in the case of the Hydrans, basically have a smaller partner race slash empire, that would be part of the whole Hydran empire. I think that probably seem a little more reasonable overall when it comes to more, I think, a more logical conclusion. Now, along the lines of the different forces being combined and working together, unfortunately, I don't know that much about the Borak technologies when it comes to their ships and whether that actually could work out. It could be possible. Now, when it comes to on the F&E scale, obviously there's always a question when it comes to F&E, and introducing a change like that to F&E, I know it's currently, it'd be considered an alternate history, but it has definitely have some effects overall when it comes to the overall board game, the overall F&E game itself, because of if some of the economic resources that normally would go to Hydrax, the Hydran Empire, are funneled over to the Borak, you're going to have some reduction in resources available for the Hydran. Therefore, they're also, from what I understand, in the F&E terms, the Hydrans are a weaker empire versus the Klingons. And that's why they basically are completely pushed off map. And the whole idea of, at the beginning, when it comes to the Hydrans, is that they're doing a holding action. And because sooner or later, they're going to be pushed off map. And when it comes to the schedule for the ships, and I don't know this for certain, so anyone knows F&E better than I do, which is please speak up, and feel free to email me sfuoncall@gmail.com. And that is that when it comes to production, my guess is that there would be some limitations on what you actually could, add when it comes to the Borak, because the Boraks definitely have a smaller fleet overall, and therefore their schedule would reflect that according to the schedule, they didn't build that many ships, and so therefore increasing the number of ships for the Borak. Yes, just give more resource to the Borak versus that you would normally get to the Hydrans, but it wouldn't offer that many more ships compared to the actual Hydran economic base.
Well, here's the thing with F&E. You got two ways to do that. One is you can do it by their economy. In other words, whatever the scale of their economy will self-limit what they could actually build. And the other is you could literally just write your own schedule for them. So there you go.
Okay.
Take your pick. That's just my guess off the top. I'm sure there's somebody out there who knows a hell of a lot more about F&E than I do. And but it'll probably boil down to those two different options.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome.
Yeah, in which case, feel free to send it at sfuoncall@gmail.com. So, yeah, what was that, Gary?
Well, there's a few things about that. One of them is So in Federation and Empire, any ships that are built to peacetime standards generally have a higher economic cost than ships built to war production standards. So, for example, your average light cruiser has a certain cost, but then the war cruiser might have a bit of a discount because it's not built to the same tolerances. But the flip side is that when you get to the era of X ships, the peacetime construction ship can be upgraded to an X ship, but the wartime construction ship cannot. So they didn't know that at the time, of course, but it's just one of those unintended consequences. Now, the Hydrans, they're in F&E, of course. They have war production classes, and they run into the same problems as most other empires. But what's interesting about the Borak is that now the Borak are not in F&E just yet. But according to the data that's in Module E3, they have a quote-unquote war cruiser. But it's not really a war cruiser. It's still the old light cruiser with a bunch of refits. So it's not cheaper than another empire's true war cruiser. So in economic terms, you're basically paying that much more each in terms of economic EPs to build / upgrade all those cruisers, or the destroyers for that matter, because the war destroyer is the same sort of thing. It's basically a refit to their standard destroyer. And the flip side, though, would be that when X technology becomes available, the Borak are in a better position to upgrade their ships to X tech because their fleet is all peacetime construction standard. So, but then on the other side is, now to go back to your Vudar example, in standard F&E, there is no Vudar. Like, you don't see the Vudar homeworld, no Vudar ships. There's no reference to the Vudar in the Klingon order of battle or the Klingon production schedule. They're irrelevant. But if you go to F&E Minor Empires, they actually tell you which hex the Vudar capital is in, how much it produces. There's actually two versions of Vudar economy and order of battle that they have. One of them is the fake one that the Klingons used to convince everyone that the Vudar were really neutral or that they had broken from the Empire. The second one is the lower one, the real one, where they still were part of the Empire, but they were kind of like a satrapy, where basically they were a diplomatically convenient excuse to hang on to three Hydran provinces at the end of the war. And in that one, there's rules in terms of basically they have to, any economic points that they generate in the territory that they're assigned, half of it has to go to the Klingons. So only half of the resources that they're generating within their territory do they actually keep for their own ships. And that basically means that their production schedule is not great, but it's not supposed to be, because the only reason the Klingons even let them have ships in the first place is because they have the radiation tolerances to be able to function close to the energy barrier, where Klingon ships themselves can't work very well.
Right.
So there is a quasi-close comparison, but in this case, the Borak situation would be somewhat similar, but somewhat different, because there are the same, somewhat comparable atmospheric issues, because, you know, Hydrans live on class S gas giants, and the Borak live on terrestrial planets. So the same kind of planets that the Klingon and Lyran exiles in Hydran space live on. So, but in this idea, I mean, yes, there's two ways that you could split it. One is you could say that the Borak are still a client in the same way that the Vudar are, in that whatever economy they have, they only get half of it because the rest of it has to go to the Hydran treasury, and their shipyard is not allowed to be any bigger than what the Hydrans themselves have. But the thing is that the Hydrans have been shown to be more pragmatic in their relationship with other species compared to the Klingons. Like, the Klingons are more, doctrinally speaking, they have to be the ones in charge, and they would not tolerate a merger with another species that was on more equal terms. It has to be the Klingon Empire. It can't be the old King Commonwealth, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Hydrans, I think, would be more willing, especially if it's basically the option, the alternative is to be subjected to the Lyran and Klingon domination. I think they would basically be willing to create a more equitable relationship with the Borac, one that was maybe the Hydrants would still be the senior partner, but it would basically still be the more of a basically equal relationship in terms of how the two species collaborate together and how closely their economies are integrated. And also where the Hydrants would let the Borac be, because the Budar, even at their height, they're still clustered close to the galactic rim. Like, the Budar ships are not allowed to be further north, like towards Kzinti or Federation space or whatever.
Right.
But in this circumstance, the Borac, I would propose, would be allowed to operate anywhere in Hydrant space. Because, I mean, there's still plenty of colonies that empty planets that aren't being used, that
right, but not hydrants, used by the Hydrants, but it could be
that, yeah, the collective could, use,
right?
And also, it would basically be more likely that the Borac would be encouraged to send ships to the Hydrant, to the Klingon and Leon borders, to fight those guys, to basically help, you know, deal with those enemies as well. So that's my theory here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, understood. But I think that actually is kind of a neat idea overall, which is, I just thought of this, which is that the Borac actually have a symbiotic relationship with the Hydrants, in that they're still a minor race versus Hydrants in the Hydrant Empire, but the Hydrants would, you know, to take advantage of the Borac being terrestrially based, meaning a normal, you know, like an M-sized planet versus a gas giant, but, you know, like Jupiter or so forth, which is more akin to the Hydrants themselves as a species, that they could take advantage of that with the Borac and have them live there, build colonies there, also doing mining and other other things on that planet, you know, agricultural and that kind of thing, which would be economically beneficial to the Hydrants, and I think it'd be a heck of a lot easier than, you know, trying to take advantage of it either using an automated system, you know, robots and that kind of thing, or having Hydrants actually on those planets. But they're stuck in these encounter suits all the time, you know. That kind of thing, where you can have a symbiotic relationship with another species.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have a copy of Module E3 on your computer there?
Module E3. I will check.
Well, technically, there's two files. There's the rule book and there's also the SSD book.
Mm-hmm. At the moment, no, I do not. I have module E2, but not module. Actually, that's the errata. I don't have module E3. Yeah. C3, obviously C3A. I got C5 and C6. And R4.
Yeah, well, actually, CE3 is relatively cheap. So I guess if you want to, because it might be good to. I could have sworn that a previous episode went over the Borac, but.
Oh, there it is. Yes, I do. There it is.
Know, if you have. Yeah.
The Module E3, the Borac Star Legion rulebook. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, do you have the SSD book as well or just the rulebook?
Yeah, I got them both.
All right, so if you have the SSD. Okay. So bring up, can you bring up the SSD book and we can go to the heavy cruiser.
Sure. There's the Dreadnought, there's the heavy carrier, Dreadnought, war cruiser, battle cruiser, battle carrier, I think, heavy cruiser, there it is. There.
Now, what's interesting is that the air heavy cruiser is actually moved cost 3/4, so it's almost like it's almost like an Omega faction in terms of how distinct it is from what you see on average in Alpha. But so basically it's got various weapons. Now, some of the weapons don't appear until Y-150. So the very earliest Metal Gear ships don't have the phaser cannons, but they do have the mega phaser turrets. So the phaser cannon is basically, it's a weapon. I'm pretty sure that it takes two adjacent option mounts, but it basically lets you fire three phaser twos for the cost of two or cost of one and a half or something like that. So it's almost like if you change the Gatling phaser, so instead of being four phaser threes, it's three phaser twos.
Okay.
And the turrets, the mega phaser that's in the turret, it's the same mega phaser that's from the old module P6, but it has smaller cannon firing arcs. But in this case, the turret basically allows you to fire in 60-degree angles, which still means that there's some, like, you know, dead zones that you can't fire in. Mm-hmm. But it basically gives the weapon more flexibility than it does in a fixed mount.
Understood. How often can you turn the turret? Once a turn or multiple times a turn?
That, I can't remember. But pretty sure it's fairly often. I'm sure it's once per turn, or if it's once every 16 impulse or something. That's in the rule book anyway. But so basically this ship, and also the shuttles, they can be, they have a bit of phaser weaponry, but they're also used, they have explosive warheads that you can arm, like and they are remote controlled. So Borak ships tend to come with at least two, like one or two of them, a standard.
Okay. Page 10 is where I think it will be. Okay. I was thinking about special rules. Da-da-da. Firing arcs. Okay. Stop that for a moment. Mounted phaser G fires at the turn facing. Rotation rate. The turrets must be rotated in a 6-degree partial rotation in smaller increments. It's not possible. Okay. Oh, there it is. The turrets may not change facing more than once in any impulse, period. And I don't. So, since I don't see it saying that only can be turn once a turn, I'm assuming that it can basically be change facing multiple times a turn. Because it doesn't say explicitly say, you can only fire, only can be rotated, change rotation once per turn, and then only can also, and you're limited to limited impulse. That may not change the facing more than once an impulse period. So I'm assuming that it means that you can do multiple times per turn. So, which is cool. That makes sense because I'm
so still, no
third facing turn. But anyway.
Now, this ship. In SFB anyway, because FedCom doesn't have phaser capacitors, but in SFB, at least, the fighting style is basically designed around its capacitors. So it does, the ship itself doesn't have a huge amount of power, generator power at least. But so what the tactics in the rulebook advise is to begin the battle by using the phaser capacitors to fire the mega phasers at range. And then once you soften up the opponent and refill the capacitors, the shorter range weapons like the phaser cannons and stuff can be used up close to try to finish something off. But of course, whether your opponent's going to let you do that is another story. But in this case, if you think about like that ship in a squadron with a Hydran ship, those phaser cannons and the other phaser, smaller phasers that they have, they can become very useful if you're trying to deal with enemy drones.
Mm-hmm. Oh, agreed.
And the shuttles can also come in handy when you're dealing with ESGs, because if you place the shuttles at a certain position, then you can soak up damage that would otherwise destroy stingers. So there might be ways that this ship can basically leverage its firepower in a way that benefits the Hydrants in particular.
Right. And the one thing I was just... Definitely, I agree that especially with the Mega Phaser, that could help out greatly when it comes to the use of the Hellbores. Now, obviously, fusions also involved in there. The one thing I was looking at actually with the Borak is that they have looks like initially, if you're not actually looking carefully, that the Borak runs the same issue that the Saltorians run into, which is that they have no seeking weapons. So they have nothing to deter you from closing in.
Yeah, but...
basically.
They're basically, with the exception of the Hunter Cradle shuttles, they don't have... So they're kind of like the opposite of the Paladine. Because you think about it, Paladine are the Lyran off-map subjugated species, and their ships have all seeking weapons, so drones and plasmas. Whereas these guys are the reverse. They have no drones or plasmas or quantum wave torpedoes or anything like that. They just have direct fire weapons. And
right. But
as with the Hydrans, their shuttles are their seeking weapons.
Yeah, but the one thing I want to point out about that is that it's deceiving to a certain degree. And that is, looks like even if there's a regular heavy cruiser, a heavy cruiser has two fighters. Which are a phaser 2 and a phaser 3, which in theory, those can be your seeking weapons. Like the Hydran do.
Yeah, because, as I say, they hate the hunt. Yeah, although the difference is that the Borak have two iterations of fighter. One of them is a more kind of traditional superiority fighter, and the other is a fighter that basically acts like a suicide shuttle. So these guys, the Hunter Killers, the idea would be that you'd basically arm them like a suicide shuttle, and then you would remote control them into the enemy ship at some point during the engagement. So you don't have to, because as I say, like say if you're fighting the Lyrans, maybe you want to use those shuttles, the so-called BSG hits or something like that. But that is one of the more kind of common ways that the Borak have that kind of, at least close up, because you don't want to be too far away from the shuttles. And also, I think it's also because the shuttles are, these Hunter Killers are faster than regular admin shuttles. So you're not as slow as you are with a regular suicide shuttle.
That's weird. I'm looking at, I'm looking at the battle carrier where they have FDCs, which have, speed 15 is standard kind of thing. But it has two phaser threes going in the forward arc and one phaser two in the rear extended arc, which is kind of whacked, I think, overall when it comes to arcs. And then the JMB, which I'm not exactly sure what that is. It looks like an EW fighter. Because it has two EW pods. And then it has two phaser threes and two phaser three FA and one phaser three RX, which, as I said, makes sense. If this is basically your EW fighter.
Well, I guess the Borak fighters are designed to fire into the oblique. So you're not going directly. That's where the RX phaser cert 2 would come in. And but I think part of it's basically due to the engineering limitations involved with it, because I guess the Borak have to work with certain options in terms of like what the counter can do. Oh, and by the way, there's a couple of other things as well, because I think if you go to the next page after the heavy cruiser, you see a thing called the heavy expansion cruiser, mm-hmm. which is actually the middle years heavy cruiser, because the Borak. Okay, so there's actually a couple of ways in which this hull evolved. So the original expansion cruiser had no phaser cannons. It still had the turret, but it also had option boxes, because mm-hmm. in the version of history that was created by the Hydrans and the simulators, the expansion mm-hmm. ships were also used for things like, for example, say, for example, the non-mapped option boxes. You could basically put barracks into them so that you could transport colonists to new planets, because the idea is that the Borak were using whatever ships they had to expand in a hurry. So that was one option. Or you could create a command cruiser by turning two of the non-match option boxes into flag bridge boxes. But then, according to the history at least, in Y-150, the phaser cannon gets invented, and also the Borak are said to consolidate their territory. So they refit the ship into the standard heavy cruiser. And so they get rid of the option boxes and they add the phaser cannons. And so the ship becomes more powerful as a combatant. But then on top of that, there's a later refit where the later refit basically allows them to fire the phaser cannons as a single phaser one instead of firing it as three phaser mm-hmm. twos.
Right.
So say, for example, if they have to do a, like, depending on the situation, like if the situation warrants the longer range of the phaser one compared to the short range of the phaser twos, they can do that. So yeah, basically it's but it's interesting to see the parallels with how the Hydrans are developing, because in the middle years the Hydrans developed the Stinger One and the Ranger and the Lancer, so they've got weaker warp engines and they don't have any Hellbores yet, but they do have the fusion beam, and the Stinger Ones don't have the phaser G, they just have a single phaser three and the two fusion beam shots. So their battles are basically being fought up close. So a Borak expansion cruiser with its mega phaser is actually giving like a squadron a different, you know, dynamic at range. But then if you fast forward to the time when, by the time the Hydrans do develop the Hellbore and they develop the Stinger II, the Borak have basically added the phaser cannon and the refits of the phaser cannon to their suite of weapons. So now the two sides have basically got new technologies that, when used the right way, could overlap even further. Like, say, for example, if you've got like a Dragoon, you don't have as many fighters, or in SC, you've got no fighters at all. So your short range punch is weakened. But if your friendly Borak cruiser is flying alongside you with its phaser cannons ready to go, then if you're on a reload turn for your Hellbores, then whoever tries to come close to you will basically have to fly through those phaser cannon shots and mega phaser shots, whatever, to get to the Dragoon. And they might not want to do that. So basically, and even though so that the Borak are not given Aegis fire control, because the assumption is that they've got enough phasers that they don't really need it. But even without Aegis, you're still basically turning their cruiser into a de facto heavy escort for that Dragoon, or for maybe a Hydran carrier, like a true carrier or something like that. So maybe instead of building escort variants of their war cruisers, they're putting a Borak cruiser in there, like a Borak war cruiser or heavy cruiser instead, and they're getting the same de facto effect from its phaser suite.
Yeah, I was looking at the. Actually, I have not. I'd have to look at the ships a lot more, because I'm not sure when the phaser, what ships actually received the phaser cannons. Oh, there it is. Oh, I'm an idiot.
So,
I noticed the heavy cruiser has two of them.
Yeah. Yes, they're. So there's three variants of the standard heavy cruiser, three combat variants, I should say. One of them replaces the gets rid of a turret and adds two more phaser cannons. So it's got four phaser cannons in total. Now that would be a really good escort ship for a Hydran carrier. The alternative, it actually removes, I think it removes both phaser cannons and it gives you a second turret, but the turret has to be in on the prow of the ship. So it only has like a 60 degree traversal, or like a 120 traversal or something like that. So it can't, it's very limited in terms of where it can fire. And it only has one turret instead of two. So the bombardment, I think it's the bombardment cruiser or something like that. It's in the FSD book, but it only has three mega phasers, not four.
Oh, there it is. Because, okay.
So yeah. But so yeah. So the trick is if you're doing a combined fleet, because in the quote unquote quasi historical timeline, the Bulwarker said not to get great use out of either of those two variants within themselves. But if you're allied with the Hydrans, would that alliance basically make either of those two mission variants more or less viable in terms of actually deploying it and getting the most out of it? Right. And I would say yes for the one with the phaser cannons at least. The turret one, I'm not so sure about. Because especially by the time you've got Hellbores, I don't know if you're going to get that much of an advantage from that added mega phaser, except for the fact that the mega phaser fires every turn.
Yeah, that's the one thing I was thinking about is that the bombardment on cruiser to me seems obviously it's for heavier hitting than a regular heavy cruiser, but but limits the number of phasers itself. Interesting. But yeah, I can see that being used as.
Don't tell you what.
Yes. It's kind of a capital ship where, you know, you're going to use that for hitting a farther away targets. To a certain degree.
The Hydrans have, you know, the Hydran tug, you know, they have the various like combat pallets and stuff.
Yeah.
They have a fire support pallet. And that one is basically almost like an Iridani ship, is that the Hellbores are basically fixed to L or R firing arcs. If you have a tug with the fire support pallet attached, supporting that ship, these bombardments variant 4X ships might be more useful because you're trying to stay at range with the tug in the first place, and you're adding the weight of fire of the mega phasers to whatever you're shooting at.
Understood. And the problem with mega Jack. I forget how much it costs to charge a mega phaser. Because it's right here. Direct damage. Come on. It doesn't say. There it is.
I'm pretty sure it costs as a phaser four. It's like 2.5 points of power.
1.5 points of power. No, that's the early mega phasers.
Okay, so even cheaper than a phaser four. Yeah. I think the standard one is 2. But the other thing to bear in mind is that it's worth taking care to note each mega phaser and each phaser cannon, how many phaser capacitor points they're adding to your ship. Because I think that at the start of each turn, at the start of a game or other, if you have weapons that is 3, I suppose, your phaser capacitor is full, but the size of the capacitor is, I guess it's 1 point for every phaser 1 or 2, then it's 0.5 point for every phaser 3. And I want to say it's every 2 points for your phaser cannon, and it's 2 points for a mega phaser.
Yeah, definitely 2 points for mega phaser.
If you are not using...
I
think it's 2 points as well. I might be mistaken.
Cannons.
Yeah. So you basically have to...
Right up 3 times. Yeah, 2 points. because it costs 2/3 points of so, energy to fire a phaser 2 from a phaser cannon.
Yeah. So you basically, if your plan is to use the phaser cannons, then you're drawing the power from what, because you're not, because I mean, like, you're not assigning the less faster energy to any particular phaser, that's the whole point, whatever. But it also means that even if you do plan to use only one set of phasers for the first few turns, you're still going to have to refill that capacitor eventually. So that is basically part of the key issue that standalone Borax fleets have, or ships or fleets have. But if you're working in tandem with the Hydrans, then I guess you basically have to kind of plan and try to plan as well in terms of if the squadron is moving a certain way, are you timing those movements to basically, like, are you trying to kind of like have the recharging happening at the same time? So for example, the reload turn for the Hellebores is the same turn that you're using for the Borax to recharge the clusters. Or are you doing it the opposite? Are you basically trying to have it so that the capacitors are being reloaded on the turn the Hellebores are firing, and you're basically trying to cover that fire? Oh no, you're letting the firing cover your charging, if that makes sense. And you also, yeah, so it, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know if I'm explaining it too well. Like, are you basically trying to have it so that you're crossing in terms of like which turn you're firing or planning to use these weapons, or you're having them fire concurrently and charging concurrently, if that makes sense?
Yeah, sorry, I was just, I just had an idea about a system for a ship, but I think it's already done in the LMC, which is the whole idea of just a pure phaser bank, you know, which you fire your phasers from, but the bank itself could be larger than the capacitors of the phasers, that kind of thing. Instead of having capacitors as part of the phasers,
the bank
would be separate from the phaser itself. And I thought that might have been something that was part of one of the LMC races.
Yeah, that's right. The LMC banks have, they can store 4 points of power for the lasers. But some ships have generous banks, but they still have to charge them afterwards. Mm-hmm. And other units. So, for example, the Badavai have a laser variant of their fast patrol ship, but it doesn't have enough bank power to fire everything at once.
Hmm. Okay. I have to look at C5. Actually, I was just looking at it, and I don't have the ebook version. My guess is it's probably in the box, mm-hmm. which is right over here.
I could have swore you told me you just saw C5 in your files there.
What was that? I did what?
Because earlier, while you were looking for E3, you were going through some of the PDFs that you saw, and I could have sworn you said you saw C5 there.
I got the C5, but I got the SSD book. I don't have the rule book. That's the problem.
So I guess we don't have too much time left, but for future consideration, it might be an idea to one day on the show delve into the Borax, maybe do a bit of reading, you know, homework between now and then, just to freshen up a bit on what the rules and SSDs are like. And not just for their own sake, but also to kind of see, is there that opportunity to have them and the Hydrans support each other
mm-hmm.
in game terms?
Right.
And what would the tactics look like if you pit them against Lyran, Klingon, or even Andromedan opposition? Like, what would the Andrels do if you had like a combined Borax Hydran force fighting them?
Hmm. Yeah, the biggest issue, obviously, with the Andromedans and just, you know, a phaser based weapon, which is unlike the disruptors. Disruptors have that disrupting ability. Whatever. I think it's just I think it's just another toy for the Klingons. I think that's what it is. Just like, you know, the Assassin's Creed generator is, and of course the ability to have all the phaser fire directly out the butt of the Klingons, some of the Klingon ships, which is highly annoying. I'm running away from you, but I can still fire at you. What? Okay.
Sounds fair. They need all the help they can get. Come on.
Grumble, grumble. The Andromeda's supposed to take over the galaxy.
They lost to a drinking contest in the old frickin' series. Come on. And they're going to be the rulers of the galaxy. Yeah, okay, gotcha. Couldn't hold their liquor with Scotty. What good are they?
I think you talked about the Andorans.
Technically, they're not the same.
No, that was the Andro one.
Okay.
Well, hello, kitty cat.
Yeah, my cat is gone at the moment. Yeah.
My furball has decided to say hello.
Hi, Dakota.
Omaha.
Omaha, Omaha.
That's okay.
Forgive me. Anyway, okay.
For now, all you need are Utah, Gold, Juno, and Sword.
What's that?
Oh. I was saying now all he needs are Utah, Gold, Juno, and Sword.
Well, as you said, I think with that, it is getting... That time, the pumpkin time, where I turn into a pumpkin. If all of a sudden you see my head just be look like a pumpkin, you'll know why. Anyhow, Gary, it was wonderful talking to you about the Borak and having possibly a better, more of a symbiotic relationship with the Hydrans, where they work more closely together. So.
Thank you. It's just a shame that Shapeways is gone for now, because there actually had been Borak ships with movable turrets on the storefront. So, fingers crossed, some form of storefront for ADB appears in the future, and the Borak will be back on there again.
Yeah, that's a good question, which is I think everyone who buys miniatures is interested in finding out. When it comes to at least the newer miniatures, not the old ones, because I'm pretty sure my understanding is that ADB still has the old metal ones. It's just that the new 3D printed ones can no longer be 3D printed because they don't have a store to create them and sell them. And before anyone mentions it, because it's already been said on Facebook, and I'll just remind here, ADB will not sell the 3D plans. I forget what kind of file it's called, but they will not sell those plans so you can print them out yourself. So that's not going to happen.
I know that would only be profitable. I mean,
it
literally costs them zero production money. They don't have to print things and ship them.
Yeah, but they still have to pay.
And then somebody's on his own.
Yeah, but they still have to pay.
Well, yeah, but they set the price.
Right.
It doesn't have to be like a penny. You know, it could be like $10 to get the file, and the file only has so many uses or whatever. I don't know.
Understood.
So.
Okay. Anyway, it's not going to happen, so let sleeping dogs lie before they bite you. Okay. Well, Gary, it was nice having you around. You have a good night.
Have a night.
Night.
Hey, Doug. Anything you wish to promote this week?
Why, yes. Yes, there is. As a matter of fact, something that I would love to promote. It is coming up in only about a month from now.
Yep.
Oh, my gosh. We're down to 4 weeks now to Gamers of Summer. Yeah, 4 weeks. And we will kick it off on Saturday morning of Labor Day weekend through Monday afternoon. So, yeah, well, actually Monday evening, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully we can have some kind of SFB goodness there.
Yep. That'd be
I mean, there's going to be a lot of other stuff going on. That's kind of basically it. Anybody wants to run anything, feel free to pop in there. We are relatively convenient for the East Coast. You know, I wouldn't ask somebody to drive here from like Milwaukee or, you know,
Indianapolis,
anywhere. Oh, good. No. Yeah. But, or Texas or Oklahoma, Panhandle. Oh, yeah. California.
That's
nuts. We're a small regional thing, small, like, itty bitty tiny little event. We have space.
Yes, what I call it.
We have table space.
Single room convention is what it is. The big room.
And you know what?
But it's a
you know what?
It works great.
We're at a regular, nice, big old hotel right now, and the venue has offered to us that if we have overflow, we can literally double our size just by asking them, because the room across from us is available usually. So, and they have like four rooms. They have at least four large meeting rooms like that. So we have space for expansion.
Mm-hmm.
We just kind of would need like need people body. To need expand people to into them.
Yep.
Yar.
Come and gain.
So, yeah, that's basically it.
Yep. Okay. Well,
pretty much.
Doug, you have a good night.
Thank you. I'll talk to you sometime next week, hopefully, if not on a podcast, some other day.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Okay.
So, had a nice little discussion there talking about the Borak and the possibility of having a more symbolic relationship with the Hydrans and how that would affect both, F&E type play, and obviously some tactical implications if there was a combined fleet when it comes to the Borax and the Hydrants, which would be interesting to do. So with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.